Welcome to the Non-Op series for the Minerals and Royalties podcast, where EMPs and drilling capital meet the minerals and royalties space.
Hey guys, this is Tim Powell from the Minerals and Royalties Authority. I recently sat down with James McGee and Russ McGowan, the co-founders of nonopwells.com, an online marketplace built to bring liquidity to wellbore AFEs. During the episode, James and Russ break down all things AFEs, including total addressable market, trends and deal flow from basin to basin, and the different structures they're seeing on transactions between buyers and sellers. Let's jump into the episode and hear more of what James and Russ had to say.
All right, Russ, James, welcome on to the podcast. Looking forward to talking all things AFE market. Now, Russ, we met playing basketball, right? Isn't that correct?
That's right, man. You smoked me. I was out of shape, but that was a good time, man. That was a couple of years ago.
That is the first and, to this point, the last industry basketball thing I played. And I'll give a shout out to Leo Slutsky. You know, I'm 6'8", for those who don't know my exact height. So I'm a big guy. I used to play basketball. It was a lot of fun, but I was gassed. Like, I was so tired going up and down the court. And Leo's 6 foot, maybe a little shorter, but fit guy, right? In the last run, he had to guard me. And he's just like, I'm going to apologize in advance. I'm going to be as annoying as possible. I'm going to like really try to beat the shit out of you, like physically, like boxing out and everything. And to that point, like everyone was just having a good time. And then Leo just really, there's nothing worse. It brought me back to high school days, like the shorter, stockier, like really like strong, like wiry strength guys that would just take my legs out on box outs because they were so much shorter. So yeah, I was sore for a week. I think my big toe was black and blue. One of my nails almost fell off. I was destroyed, but I would love to do it again. I haven't gotten an invite back, or maybe they haven't done it as much, but neither here nor there. That was the early days of, you know, Non-Op Wells, and now it's, you guys are growing and continue to stay active. So curious to hear an update what's going on. But yeah, always love to start with, you know, any kind of fun origin story like that. Over to you guys on the professional side. You know, talk to me about how you got in the space. You're both kind of a little bit different career paths and how you got to this point and starting this venture. But over to you, where you grew up, where you went to school, where you're oil and gas in the family. You know, both of you kind of have a finance bent to your background. So, you know, James, why don't you kick it off and then Russ, then we'll jump into now and your platform.
Sure. I can't relate at all on the basketball side of things. I'm from Canada, so I'm a hockey player and really moved down here in 2015. I started off from just outside of Calgary, Alberta, grew up on a cattle ranch there and third generation oil and gas. So through a healthy dose of nepotism, I got into the industry. My dad worked for Shell Oil up in Calgary. And so in college in the summers, I would go into the field, the Canadian oil sands mostly, and work for an oil field services company up there. So really learned the industry from the field perspective first, which I think I'm happy that's the way it played out, because now I get a firsthand understanding of what actually goes on in the field, even though we're not out there as much anymore. And so worked for a service company for a number of years. And then when I finished college, realized that I didn't want to work in the frozen tundra of the North for the rest of my career. So I moved over to the finance side of the business and I did equity research for an investment bank in Calgary. And through that, they were opening up an office in Houston. So I literally moved down to Texas in 2015, having never been here before. Friday Night Lights was the only view I had on Texas, which I thought was great. So it's been awesome since moving here. The industry took a little bit of a turn in 2015. And I moved over to work for a hedge fund from the investment bank that I was working with. And we managed an upstream portfolio and we were long only. So it was a really pretty difficult time through that period, but it's since rebounded and it's been great to watch everybody come out of that and the growth that's happened. When we sold the fund, I moved over and got an opportunity to work at Callon Petroleum on the business development team. And we were working on a lot of larger M&A transactions during that time. And we were also getting AFE'd on our non-operated position. And we had a pretty tight budget, particularly through 2020. And so we were selling a lot of our non-operated AFEs that came in the door. And we would do that typically through an email process, very similar to what the Wellbore Wednesday is, the famous one that is out there.
Welcome to An Ounce of Prevention. The team at Our Recent Associates has partnered with Tim Powell to bring you brief legal updates on issues that matter to mineral owners, non-ops, and operators. We hope you find this segment informative. As always, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me, Rachel Reese, at podcasts@rreeselaw.com. Today's case is a recent ruling by the Texas Supreme Court about force majeure. It's called Point Energy Partners Permian LLC versus MRC Permian Company. In this case, MRC is an operator who mistakenly scheduled drilling operations after their lease lapsed. Instead of releasing the lease, MRC invoked the lease's force majeure clause, stating that difficulties on another well strained their resources and resulted in their failure to timely take action. The force majeure clause in MRC's lease provided that when a force majeure event delays operations and timely notice is given, the lease shall remain in force during the delay and lessee shall have 90 extra days to resume operations after the force majeure event ends. MRC claimed a wellbore instability issue on a separate, unrelated lease set MRC's operation schedule back by 30 hours on all upcoming wells and constituted a force majeure event on this lease. Therefore, MRC argued, because of a 30-hour delay, they should be entitled to an extra 90 days. The Texas Supreme Court, however, disagreed. When evaluating MRC's argument, the court pointed out that even if the force majeure event didn't occur, MRC would still not have met their deadline, and their lease would have lapsed. In other words, while the wellbore instability could technically qualify as a force majeure event, the court found that there was no causal nexus between the wellbore instability and the lapsing of the lease, and therefore, the force majeure clause did not apply. So why should you care? Lease termination is a big deal. Force majeure is often used as a defense to lease termination, but how it works and what is allowed is determined by the language of your contract. It's not a catch-all saving grace. Make sure, if you're going to invoke force majeure, that you have a good, valid reason and that you are following the clause in your contract to the letter. Thanks for listening, and I hope you found this informative. Thank you to Siam Rahman, a law clerk in our Houston office, for helping draft this segment. As always, subscribe to our blog, An Ounce of Prevention, or follow RRNA on LinkedIn for the latest updates.
The information and material in this advertisement is general information about our practice and firm and is for educational and informational purposes only. This information does not offer specific legal advice, and the use of this information does not create an attorney-client relationship with RRNA or any of its attorneys. The information in this advertisement should not be considered legal advice, and persons should not act upon this information without first engaging professional legal counsel.
Who's responsible for coining the term Wellbore Wednesday? Is that a company? I'm curious. I've never thought of that, but is there folklore around that?
There isn't, and I've heard a few different stories, so I don't want to claim that I know who initiated that, but we tried to basically run a copycat version at Callen, and it went okay, but we realized that there is a large market of buyers in the space that are looking for these wellbore interests, and you need to move very quickly because typically when you get AFE'd, you're on the consent clock, and you need to make your election within 20 to 30 days. And so we thought that there could be a better way to organize it, which is why we came up with the platform. So we go out to all the institutional buyers that are in the space in the lower 48 and try and get these opportunities in front of them as quickly as we can so that it's almost like a just-in-time capital solution for the sellers and where they're knowing that they're getting the best quality buyers on the other side of that. And I'll flip it over to Russ and he can give a little bit of his background before we dive into the actual company.
Russ, over to you, your background, and then we'll jump into the Now platform.
Yeah, I mean, I'm also kind of a transplant from the North. Probably, I don't even think I knew what oil and gas was until I was out of college. So, you know, I come from Chicago, went to school in Ohio, at Miami, Ohio, and then out of school, went into banking as well. And I honestly had no idea what I wanted to do and was with a bank called Standard Chartered at the time and basically was in this leadership and development program where you got to rotate around teams and spent some time with the oil and gas team and loved it. It was one of the best teams there. And you know, they said, hey, if you want to be on that team, you're going to have to go to Houston. So I didn't really have a choice and came down here and loved it, man. You know, just the banking side at Standard Chartered was specifically to bring in international. So we were big in Asia, Africa, Middle East. And so you'd use the balance sheet that you lend, you know, overseas and try to get some strategic advisory work over here in the U.S. And at the time, everybody was, you know, from Asia was invested in the LNG export plants from the equity side. And I think everyone's plan was, hey, let's try and basically get the upstream hedge by going to acquire gas. And so the whole time was basically trying to get gassy assets, you know, bring in those guys into, you know, the Eagle Ford, Haynesville, whatever it might be. And it was a very long and challenging process to get some of those in, but it was fun. But ultimately ended up switching over to a U.S. team that was kind of just doing more onshore, you know, A&D and capital markets. So that was Canadian Bank. That's actually where I met James. He was on the research side and I was on the banking side. But I always had the itch to kind of go out and leave banking. I kind of went into banking to get out of banking. And so had the opportunity to basically do a startup in East Texas. Went out with a couple of guys, ex-BHP guys, and we were just doing mostly, I'd say, kind of the more conventional Cotton Valley gas stuff. But we did have, you know, some exposure to Haynesville, and that's kind of where I first got started in the AFE game. We spent a lot of time trying to figure out if you want to participate in well, and, you know, for a smaller company, that is a big portion of what you invest in. But yeah, so we did that for a couple of years. And then after that, tried to start my own thing with a couple of guys out in the Permian, and 2017-18 was hot. And so we just kind of got blocked and tackled out of what we wanted to acquire. And so I don't think I'm alone there, but it was a good learning experience. Still track those assets and see who's developing. It's a fun what if, what could have been. But yeah, so after that, I was lucky enough to join an NGP-backed company called Torrent Oil. And that was run by ex-Hillcorp guys. And so the focus was kind of conventional Gulf Coast oil and gas, highly structured salt dome stuff. And then we also put together a play in the Central Louisiana Chalk play at probably the rough time. A lot of great geology there, but just wasn't the right timing for development. Followed, you know, kind of EOG and Conoco and Marathon in there, and just, you know, kind of rode the wave up and then rode the wave down. So yeah, after that, James was kind of talking about doing non-op wells, and I kind of, you know, from a different perspective, saw that the challenges of non-op in general. You know, we had a decent amount of non-op at all my former companies. And, you know, it's really just, you know, when you're an operator, it's not the focus of your company. And, you know, trying to figure out how to properly, you know, monetize and make something out of your non-op is, you know, something that probably doesn't get as much love as it often did. And when James started talking about the complex, you know, situation that he was running into with Cal and AFEs, and, you know, then we started looking into the broader market, it just really got the juices flowing. And James has a bit of a past in kind of creating software platforms. He did a couple of stuff in college. And so I thought, yeah, let's do this. 2020, no one knew where life was going, and why not try and do something different, bring technology into the tool belt that I didn't have. And James has been one of my best friends for a long time. So what better time and what better team to start a company with? So we just dove in.
So it was a COVID baby. That my business is a COVID baby too. So that's interesting. So explain exactly what non-op wells is, just kind of high level. You talked about it a little bit in your intro, James, but what exactly have you built? And then we'll go into like the nuances, and, you know, you feel like the value adds and how you feel you're making the process a little more streamlined. It'd be interesting too, as you answer that, talking from the perspective of the buyer and the seller, the pain points that have traditionally been on both sides, but over to you guys. So the origin story of, you know, how it was built and what it is exactly, just for everyone listening.
Yeah. So really what it is in a nutshell is a platform that allows sellers to list their AFE interest once it's received from the operator. And it allows the buyers to bid on it through a sealed bid auction format. And it's very simple in explanation.
Yeah. I mean, the whole concept is, you know, we want to be an option for, you know, we like to call it the third option, which is anytime you get an AFE in the door as a non-op working interest owner, your first option is to either participate or not consent. The second is to work out a trade with the operator, since typically they would be interested in acquiring more interest. And the third is to see what the market would tell you it's worth. And so, you know, we kind of want to be that third option, which is, all right, maybe you've decided you don't want to participate. Maybe you haven't. Maybe you're running economics and you're not sure. But because everything is on such a short time clock, we've got just an easy and simple way for you to consider that third alternative, which is, all right, you know, if I don't have the capital for this, or someone's willing to pay me more for it, you know, let's look at that option.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to all of our podcast sponsors. Looking to ramp up your deal flow for your minerals and non-op ground game? Since 2019, the Texas Mineral Company has closed on over 150 deals totaling $135 million in value. In 2023 alone, they closed 32 transactions with deal sizes ranging from $50,000 upwards of $5 million. Whether you're looking for white space, development drilling, or PDP, the Texas Mineral Company has got you covered. For more information on how to source more deal flow, please reach out to Toby Martinez at toby@thetexasmineralcompany.com. Over the past 20 years, Riverbend Energy Group has been the definitive leader in the non-op and mineral space, where they are actively acquiring minerals in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, the Williston, and the Eagle Ford. Following their $1.8 billion sale of their non-op platform in 2022, they are also back actively acquiring non-op interests in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and Williston. If you have minerals or non-op working interests in these areas that you would like to sell, then please visit www.riverbendenergygroup.com for more information. Farmers National Company has oil and gas experts located across the country ready to provide you unmatched convenience and service for your land management needs. Whether you're looking for turnkey management of oil and gas interests or simply looking for an advisor to help you sell or lease your minerals, Farmers National Company has you covered. Learn more about Farmers National Company's team of certified mineral managers, landmen, attorneys, and accountants by going to fncenergy.com or reach out directly at energy@farmersnational.com. Does your team ever struggle with employee turnover? What about right-sizing your team to fit your company's needs over time? Do you have the right accounting systems and software in place to maintain control and visibility on all your cost centers? If any of these things are challenges in your business, then Opportune's back office outsourcing could be the right solution. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com.
So you mentioned the clock. Like, how when folks are listing stuff, is it normally like, oh shit, we have 10 days? Like, because the stories I hear from AFE buyers is they get a phone call and someone's like, oh, Susie was on vacation. She came back and there was some AFE proposal on her desk. And now we got 10 days and we don't want to go non-consent. Like, can you work up an offer for us? And it's usually like relationship driven. Is it mostly E&P companies that are listing the AFEs, or is it really a cross section? I guess is the first question.
It's a lot of E&Ps. We've been live for just over a year. And from a seller standpoint, that's really where we've targeted. And mostly because that's where our relationships are. And what we tried to build is something that we would have used in-house. So we've made it very simple for the seller to list. All the listings go up same day. We don't run any economics on our side, and we've made it so the sellers have no obligation to sell. So like Russ said, we're just kind of that third option. Get your bids in hand while you're comparing, or while you're running your internal economics, then you can compare the two and make a decision. We don't like to do the fire drill situations. I think probably the fastest we've had one turned around is in 48 hours, but most of the auctions run for around 2 weeks. We like to have it up there for a week and a half to 2 weeks. And then that typically gives you another week and a half to 2 weeks to close.
You know, if you're talking about pooling in Oklahoma, the day that order is issued, there's 20 days. And that doesn't mean if you're not tracking it, you may not know what happened. So you may have less than that. You know, standard JOA would have 30. As far as that instance where, you know, Mary goes on vacation, she comes back and there's something on her desk. Well, it also depends on the level of organization. I mean, the larger E&Ps are getting those via email too. So, you know, it sort of depends on, you know, your scale and in your organization itself, because there's different levels of, I guess, tracking when it comes in. But yeah, I mean, the best way to say it is, look, if you get something via standard JOA and it comes in, you stamp it, you got 30 days. The best way we like to communicate to sellers is take a couple of days to digest it. That's fine. But at least, you know, no longer than a week, let us know that you want to list it so that we can list it for a week or two, because the buyers out there, you know, there's a lot of opportunities for them. And so their pipelines are large and, you know, they need a little bit of time to put that in the pipeline, and they don't all have capacity to just turn stuff in a couple of days. Some of them can, but the majority will need more than that. But beyond 2 weeks, you know, it's probably going to get pushed to the back of the pipeline just because there's other pressing stuff. So, you know, there's not too much of an advantage beyond 2 weeks. And, you know, like James referenced, you know, part of the process for bringing buyers to our platform is everyone's got to have a couple of different criteria to get on. So we spent a lot of time, you know, when we created this, to do everything above board from a regulatory and compliance perspective. And so we actually did go the broker dealer route. Don't want to go into the rabbit hole of whether or not wellbore interest and working interests are securities, but the SEC does view it that way. And so, you know, we did go the broker dealer route, and that took a while, but that means our onboarding is a little stricter. So we follow kind of a traditional investment banking onboarding. And so in order to, you know, be a participant as a buyer on the platform, you've got to have $5 million in assets under management and, you know, certify that you're sophisticated and knowledgeable to evaluate transactions. And typically what that means is it's bigger pools of capital, and they know what they're doing. They've got teams in-house for engineering, geo, and they've got the databases set up to whereby if you give them, you know, a section township range, or if you give them APIs, they're going to be able to run that pretty quickly and get to an answer of what they think roughly that well is worth. And then it's going to be up to them to decide what return threshold they're going to bid stuff down to. And so, you know, that window of 1 to 2 weeks is pretty much the sweet spot, you know, considering transaction sizes and, you know, varying levels of board board approval. So that gives them time to evaluate, get it with bids, and don't really need too much longer than that unless we're talking about kind of mega deals, you know, 25, 50 plus.
I'm just curious, just, you know, as I look at my network and how I'm growing it out, like in the Permian, which is, I know, where a lot of the rig activity is, hence a lot of the AFEs, you guys have been active in the Delaware in particular, but you have a dynamic in the Permian where I think you have a lot of minerals buyers who are high net worth family office folks. They have a lot of ordinary income exposure and they're comfortable with the Permian from a technical perspective and a well control perspective. So they may be willing to take on AFE exposure if they're looking for that kind of risk adjusted return profile bucket with IDC tax benefits. So that's a pool of capital that I think is a little bit, you know, that exists in other basins, but I think it's more prevalent in the Permian. So that's an extra layer of capital. Then you have the publics, then you have the non-op funds that are private equity, and then you have the private funds that have been raised. And so there's like all layers are playing in the Permian. And so I think it's very liquid. And in terms of onboarding on your platform, are you seeing the same cross section? Are there other types of players out there? Just curious.
Yeah, I'd say you hit the big ones. You know, in ranking order, it's probably non-op specific funds themselves or portfolio companies of PE or other, you know, investment vehicles, family offices that have traditionally been, you know, the wealth is generally generated from oil and gas. You know, it's familial family wealth from oil and gas, or over time, a lot of guys sell out for huge numbers. And then, you know, it's what everyone knows. And so they're comfortable putting their money back into oil and gas as part of their family office. You get some generalists that do cross over once they, you know, get comfortable. So there are, you know, bigger funds that have teams that look into this. You do have some hedge funds that have, you know, teams within them that will look at private investments like that. They're on the larger side there. And then you have, yeah, just, you know, what we call, you know, just local guys that are in a specific basin, you know. So you got up in the Bakken, there's people who know everything about the Bakken and they just have created wealth over time and created companies via investments, or they're an operator and they're also looking to buy non-op, just get additional exposure. But those are probably, yeah, I mean, the array of different groups. And it's just, you know, there aren't as many that will look across the lower 48. There's a lot of people who, you know, have more specific mandates. And then, you know, it just depends on, you know, everyone's got their preference for operator and different counties. And talk about New Mexico, people are down to Section Thompson Grange. And then you get guys that will only bid on Mewbourne, right? And so it's a wider range of types of investors that have different buckets of where they're comfortable putting their money.
How does it work? So is your model like you get onboarded and then you see everything, or do people say, please send me everything in the Delaware and the Midland, and they self-select? Is it, you know, they can see through the window, but they can't get in the store unless they're onboarded, so everyone can see everything, like go on your website? Like, what are the layers of visibility?
Yeah. So once you're fully registered, so if you've gone through our onboarding process, the standard AOI that we set is the entire lower 48. Then we also have, you know, within your dashboard, you can go in and filter that down to specific areas. So let's say if you're only Oklahoma and you only do Oklahoma deals, you can just unselect all and then click specifically SCOOPSTACK, Arkoma, you know, the greater MidCon, whatever you want it to be. But I'd say most people want to see everything just out of curiosity. And then, you know, the local guys will have refined areas.
Okay. Well, we were kind of chatting before we went live on your thoughts on total addressable market for AFE, you know, opportunities. You guys kind of look at it just from a wellbore perspective. It's hard to quantify dollars because it's not so easily trackable, the working, its percentage, carry versus cash, so on and so forth. But like on an annual basis, what are you guys kind of seeing? And yeah, and we'll just focus on shale plays for now, right? And not the conventional stuff. Just amount of AFEs hitting the market or new wells hitting the market. How do you guys kind of look at that? Yeah, because it's an important thing as a business. You guys need to understand, you know, okay, if we're going to try to take a portion of this market and bring liquidity to it, we want to know how big it is, right? So what do you guys see from your perspective?
Yeah, so we actually, and we think this is kind of one of our differentiators, but we spend most of our time in the courthouse, which is, you know, how we kind of figure out who the players are in the entire game. And so we've been tracking as much as we can all wellbore transactions, you know, and specifically, you know, AFE transactions or near-term development transactions, whatever you want to call them. anything where the transaction is kind of happening where you can tell it's either got an AFE or it's done, you know, within a month or two of, you know, spud. And so we look at those and we've got about, I don't know, over 4,000 wells that have transacted since 2020. And so it's about, I don't know, 1,200, 1,300 different transactions. I'll caution that with, we need to update Q4 for a couple of basins, but we're pretty comfortable saying that, you know, in the Delaware Basin, it's over a billion in net AFE transactions. You do get, you know, a lot of scale there because you've got the bigger operators that do it. Oxy, Conoco, EOG, down the line, everybody is involved in that game there. And so you have just bigger exposure from bigger companies. And so, you know, that's probably the most active. So if you consider Delaware being a billion, you know, I'd say behind that is probably the Bakken is probably second. And then Mid-Con and Powder are probably on the same level. Haynesville, to a certain extent, although it's just been a, you know, for both Haynesville and Marcellus, it's just been a wild ride for gas. So, you know, when gas was, you know, up into the high single digits, you know, there were a lot of things trading, but, you know, it's tough to get stuff done here at 160 or whatever the heck it is now. But yeah, so overall, you know, the way we see it is there's somewhere between 400 and 500 wells that transacted in 2020. That increased to between 800 and 1,000 in 2021. And in 2022, it went to 1,200, 1,400. And then 2023, it was 1,500 to 1,750. So it's just kind of really taking off. It's a lot of wells. You know, sometimes you do get transactions in the same well. So like, for instance, in New Mexico, when stuff gets pooled, you'll get multiple sellers. For instance, like Marathon and Devon both might sell under an EOG well at the same time. So, you know, those are separate transactions. But, you know, it's really taken off. And it's tough to put a number on it, to your point, because you don't know what the working interest is. You know, we don't go into every JOA to figure out what they are. But, you know, if you just use that number of transactions, you can kind of back into it. It's, you know, probably somewhere between 2 and 3 billion.
Real quick, James. So my mind kind of goes, when you say Bakken is behind the Permian, you know, I look at Bakken as a fairly developed basin and maybe not as active. You know, it's interesting. I'm guessing here, there's not a direct correlation between number of wells drilled and number of non-op AFE transactions. And so I wonder if there's like a discernible difference by basin on like selling off non-op versus maybe keeping some non-op. Again, I know you can't paint with broad brushes. Has to do with balance sheet health and the single economics. But in general, if it's like, hey, most folks are like going to just clear the board with any Anadarko non-op they have, right? Whereas they might keep 50% of their Permian non-op exposure. I don't know. Like, I wonder if there's nuances there. Do you have any insights? Does it make sense what I'm describing here?
Yeah, I think so. So economics definitely comes into play. And I think the maturity of the basin somewhat, but really what we've seen is how that basin has been leased up and what those positions and how they're structured will determine how much non-op has been created and the opportunity set there. So in some areas, and I'll use the Eagle Ford as an example, the size of the ranches meant that the companies could get larger operated positions and it didn't necessarily lend itself to create a lot of non-op. So you see fewer transactions in the Eagle Ford for that reason. And then the way that the Permian was leased up, and very similarly, the Oklahoma and the Bakken, it just lend itself to have more non-op opportunities to begin with. And then I think as we've seen the operated opportunities become harder and harder to put together, you start to have a shift in the capital chasing those non-operated opportunities. And they're going toward the areas where the economics are strong and can support their returns.
The other thing I'd add is it kind of unique to the Midland Basin portion of the Permian is that for whatever reason, the operators there tend to want to use their non-op as trade bait more than anywhere. And so you do have some bigger ranches, bigger positions, but those specific operators almost always trade in and out of their non-op instead of selling. And so that's you don't see as much transaction in the Midland Basin.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to all of our podcast sponsors. Your property is your legacy, so you should only leave it in the hands of a land management company who has a legacy of its own. If you own oil and gas interests or act as a fiduciary for those who do, you can find a long-term partner at Farmers National Company, who since 1929 has taken great pride in helping clients maximize the benefits of property ownership by providing turnkey management services and by working alongside them through generational transfers of specialized assets such as oil and gas interests and farmland. To learn more, visit fncenergy.com or reach out directly at energy@farmersnational.com. Are you looking for deal flow in the Haynesville, the Eagleford, or the Permian? What about the Scoop Stack, the San Juan Basin, or the DJ Bakken or Powder? Since 2019, the Texas Mineral Company has closed on over 150 non-op and minerals transactions in all of these basins, ranging from 50K to 5 million or 20 to 3,500 NRAs. If you're interested in finding out more information on how the Texas Mineral Company can feed you deal flow, then be sure to reach out to Toby Martinez at toby@thetexasmineralcompany.com. Scaling up your portfolio while minimizing G&A is the name of the game in the minerals and non-op space. Whether you're a brand new fund, an established team who's growing quickly, or a fully developed portfolio in harvest mode, Opportune's back office outsourcing team can help. Stop worrying about all the headaches that come along with day-to-day accounting and back office operations and contact Opportune today. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com. Over the past 20 years, Riverbend Energy Group has been the definitive leader in the non-op and mineral space, where they are actively acquiring minerals in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, the Williston, and the Eagleford. Following their $1.8 billion sale of their non-op platform in 2022, they are also back actively acquiring non-op interests in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and Williston. If you have minerals or non-op working interests in these areas that you would like to sell, then please visit www.riverbendenergygroup.com for more information.
Hi there, it's Rachel Reese at R. Reese & Associates, your outhouse counsel. You may ask, what's an outhouse counsel? Well, it's a law firm that is focused on the day-to-day legal tasks that normally would be completed by your legal department. Our attorneys in Houston and DFW have spent their careers in both in-house positions and at large law firms and can provide your company with the efficient and responsive service you would expect from your own legal department for things like contracts, transactions, and title opinions at a fraction of the cost of what you're used to paying. So whether your company has no legal department or your legal department is a mighty team of one, we can help. Give us a call at 832-831-2289 or learn more at rreeselaw.com.
Yeah, super interesting. It's true, right? Because Midland Basin is extremely fractionalized. So it's just the game of doing trades and trying to get enough to, you know, stand up a 640 or a 320 or whatever is the game. And then there's going to be folks out there, as you mentioned, James, it's harder to put together operate positions. So, you know, if they don't have large pools of capital put together, they'll chase a leasehold non-op strategy. So start putting leasehold acres together. And then when the AFEs, the development comes to them, they'll sell them off and keep an override and then reinvest. And that's a way to stay active and kind of be in the game with lower dollar amounts in terms of deployable equity dollars. You know, some minerals guys who feel like the room's a little too full, they've kind of gravitated towards a strategy like that, and they don't have enough capital to do full participation all the way through to production. For you guys, I mean, what has been the most active basin volume you're seeing, et cetera? If someone's listening and they haven't looked at deal flow on your website, well, what can they expect? You know, does it benefit a certain basin buyer? I mean, just over to you on kind of, you guys are a year in, so kind of deal flow you're seeing.
Yeah, so since we started, we've listed just over 315 wellbore interests, and about 130 of those have been in the Delaware Basin. So we're most active in the Delaware. It's where a lot of our existing relationships are. It's where there's a lot of buyers and a lot of sellers. So it somewhat makes sense that that's the most active part. But we've seen a ton of volume in the Bakken and also in Oklahoma, Powder. Marcellus is starting to pick up. Hopefully we get some uplift in gas prices and really see the wellbore market there expand. But yeah, the Delaware has been definitely the most heavily volume basin for us.
Yeah, I mean, we've closed transactions in every major basin, excluding Eagleford and excluding DJ, but they're in the pipeline. So as far as, you know, people are interested in it, what they can expect is consistent Permian, consistent Bakken, consistent MidCon, consistent Marcellus and Haynesville, and then we're working to get more Powder, more Eagleford, and more DJ.
So I have a question. Like, you guys both work for operators, so I'd love for you to put your operator hat on and just kind of talk about, you know, the firsthand experience of handling your non-op portfolios and managing non-op budgets. And you can plan for it, and it, you know, it you get these surprises, right? At the end of the day, you know, for a lot of this, like, I'm just curious, like, do you think your platform and Wellbore Wednesday, like, is it's becoming a liquid enough option to where this is the path forward for E&Ps that's preferred from logistical type perspective and obviously liquidity? I mean, I just think about the whole model of like the drill co structure and all that stuff. Like, it's complex. It's hard to negotiate, and the nuances of all the different scenarios that can pop up is just really hard. Like, is this AFE market just like what you guys are creating a better option for EMPs? It's just less headache, and you have optionality as market dynamics changes. You guys were inside. So like, what were some of the frustrations or pain points as you're managing a portfolio as an operator?
Yeah, the drill codes are pretty tricky because depending on which direction commodity prices go and which way D&C expenses go, there can be a winner and a loser, and you can try and paper it up around that, but it is very difficult to do that. And I think this solution lends itself to have more flexibility for the operators, and you can do it on a smaller scale. And I think the carry transaction style is what we do a lot of in the Permian Basin, where sellers are not receiving cash up front for their wellbore interest. They're actually getting carried by the buyer through the tanks. And that style of transaction creates a lot of alignment between the sellers and the buyers and has worked really well in the basin and doesn't require a ton of paperwork. Those agreements are generally pretty short, and there's a somewhat of a market standard out there for those now. It seems both sides really appreciate it. So I do think that the wellbore only style, if done the right way, can be a lot more effective for the sellers. And I think we'll continue to see that market grow.
Drillco's can add some simplicity to your point, Tim. There's a lot of upfront work that goes into it. You know, they can be 300 page documents, and there's a lot of legal dollar spends on it. But there is an argument to be said, okay, yeah, fine, you have the simplicity, you don't have to deal with it every time, you just send it to your counterparty, and it's under the same structure. But the downside to that is, to what James alluded to, is someone's generally left holding the bag. And it also doesn't leave the flexibility to, let's say, your capital structure changed, your budget's changed, and in the future you'd want to be participating. Or, for instance, what we talked about earlier, maybe you want to use it as trade bait. Our platform is obviously, we think the best option for everyone to be nimble and quick. And we try to simplify it. And to James's point, there's kind of a standard set of terms that most people agree to these days. But, just locking into something just takes all the flexibility. And, I think at the end of the day, there's not one single way you can do these wellbore transactions. There's a lot of unique ways you can do it. If there's a specific need you have at the time, if you're looking for cash, you do cash transactions. To James' point, you do a carry transaction to keep some exposure. A lot of EMPs say, we don't want to lose the net barrels from this. Well, great, a carry solves, you're not going to get 100% of the net barrels, but you're getting cost-free, DCF cost-free, percentage of that. Well, you still get exposure, get the well data at that point. And, it's just a great way to participate in stuff at almost risk-free way. And so, yeah, I think it will it should be the way, and most operators do it that way. A couple guys have big agreements in place and it works, but we're hoping that over time we can prove to people that, we're creating the marketplace that is, just as simple. And we take all the heavy load off of closing and we try to, we're focused on getting deals done, none of the noise. And hopefully we can prove to everyone over time that this is the market to use, and we'll provide, the best flexibility for both buyers and sellers, because it gives buyers the opportunity to decide if the right place and time is for them there as well.
The emergence of the carry structure, or the normalization or standardization of kind of that carry structure is interesting. Just kind of like food for thought on tactics for folks raising money out there for funds. I mean, blind pool fundraising is super difficult. It's a part of my business, right? It's raising capital for folks. And seed assets are helpful to mitigate some of the blind pool risk in the funds. But with the carry structure, you can get, an asset tied down without an upfront cash component. And so that can become really interesting to help fundraise around. And I've seen that used. And so just a little idea, for folks listening who, are kind of in that re-upping the next fund or starting a fund in that phase. It's just something, it's particularly if you're looking in Delaware, right? Because like you said, it's the preferred option for a lot of folks. So do you think that's specific to Delaware, or you see carries being the preferred option, across the board?
Yeah, it's definitely the most actively used in the Delaware. We're starting to see it, more operators use it in other basins. The buyers really appreciate that structure. Like you mentioned, there's no capital out the door up front, and timing is such a huge issue when it comes to non-op. So just because the well was AFE doesn't mean it's going to spud on time. We all know that these rig schedules and frac schedules change constantly. So having that flexibility from the buyer standpoint is really helpful, I think, and helps get a lot of these deals across the line. I do think it'll continue to grow in other basins, but we've seen the Delaware the most active using that type of structure.
Yeah, and part of that is, the bigger operators that are selling in the Delaware have taken that to their teams, to their other regions. So, you know, that's, I think Warriors starting to see it more in the Bucket, starting to see it more in the Powder, starting to see it more in the Haynesville. It also, from a diligence standpoint, you don't have to worry about racing to run title. Some guys still will, but, you know, if you're locking into carrying X percent of the seller's interest, whatever that interest shakes out to be, doesn't have to be 100% known when you close that deal, because it's just going to move proportionately if it does. And so, you know, that helps it as well. And then there's a lot of, you know, ways you can protect yourself both ways by not putting cash out the door on day one and not having to run really tight diligence. You have some time.
So guys, so if I'm a seller, how does the listing process work? Is it the same type of onboarding process on the sell side? And then I'm assuming you guys are broker dealers, so you can take success fees off of securities. Is the seller paying that? Is the buyer paying that? What is the model? Just for those listening who are interested.
The onboarding is very similar for the sellers as well. Once you're onboarded, it's a one and done. And then from that, the process becomes very easy. So you send us the AFE, and we also do a bring your own docs. So anything that you're comfortable with from a letter agreement assignment standpoint, you provide to us. We can give you examples and help talk through that if you don't have something off the shelf. But we generally like to have that fairly middle of the road from a commerciality standpoint, because we have to move quickly on these. There's generally not a lot of time to go back and forth on the redlining. So if you start with something that the buyers can accept right out of the gate, that helps. So we put up the AFE, the closing document, and then we do all the work on everything else. Working interest NRI, we need to, but aside from that, it's very easy to get these listed. And then in terms of our compensation, we do a buyer paid fee. So we took the typical model and flipped it on its head a little bit. And the reason we did that is because generally when the seller's moving these interests, it's because they have some sort of budget constraint. And so the buyers are typically the ones with the fresh capital that's looking to go to work. So it just made sense in our mind to have a buyer paid fee for these transactions. And I think the buyers view it as, on the fee side, as we'll just bake this into our economics when we run it and then include that in what we can bid.
Yeah, and then part of the reason we did that too is, you know, buyers want to see as many deals as they possibly can. And so we want to give sellers the fewest, you know, reasons to say no, or the lowest amount of excuses. And so if we're charging something to the seller and they have to kind of think about that, all right, well, we get these bids in and then we have to back off the fee. Everything, when you do it through the platform, you know, buyers will enter in their bid and they see, okay, here's the AFE amount. Here's what I'm going to have to pay to the operator. Here's the premium amount. Here's what I'm going to pay to the seller. And here's the closing fee. And so basically, you're able to do that. And so, you know, it's easier from that perspective. Then the seller just sees, all right, here's my net proceeds. Do I like it or not?
No, I agree with that. You guys are essentially building a marketplace. So you want supply, right? The old cheeky analogy is you want pretty girls at the bar so that the dudes come. So, you know, any pretty girls, you know, no one's going to come buy drinks at your bar. So that totally makes sense. And also too, what you said, James, they're the ones with the capital, and it's pretty standard, right? Whether it's on the ground broker deals or whatever, there's always usually some sort of origination fee being paid. So it's nothing new to buyers. So that makes all sense in the world. Listen, guys, thanks for coming on. I'll hand it over to you. Anything we may have missed, or just kind of closing messaging to those listening, how they can get involved and work with you guys. But other than that, it was great to have you on, and you know, congrats on what you got going so far. I mean, 315 wellbores listed. You called, what, 1,500 in the market or so. So it's decent market share right out of the gate for the first year. So congrats on that, and good luck with success growing over the upcoming months and years. But over to you to close it out.
No, I appreciate it. And thanks for having us on. It was great to do this, and I'll have to do it again soon. If anyone wants to get a hold of us, it's just james@nonupwells.com or russ@nonupwells.com. Really easy. Happy to have a conversation and help you out and on either the seller side or the buyer side.
Yeah. Or if anyone just wants to talk about the market, we're around and, you know, happy to talk to anyone. And Tim, can't wait to play basketball again. I think you had about half the points in that game, or the collection of runs we had, but I'll have to get in shape again.
Man, it was like riding a bike. I don't think I played pickup like that, because I used to play a lot of basketball. I could have gone to college for it. I ended up going on a golf scholarship instead. I was better at golf, but I trained for a number of years. My mentor was in the NBA, so the footwork and the fundamentals is all there. So it was like, my body knew what to do. And then I would go up and I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, I still got it. And then it would come off my finger and I would completely botch a layup. I'm like, ooh, a little rusty. If Leo Slutsky is listening right now, Leo, we want a ball again. So put it together. But anyways, guys, great to have you on. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you soon.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed. The Minerals and Royalties podcast is meant for informational purposes only. Tim Powell and the Minerals and Royalties Authority are not promoting any specific securities or investments, nor are they providing any type of investment advice. If you enjoyed the episode, then I encourage you to tune in more and also check out the Minerals and Royalties Authority YouTube channel. Thanks, and see you next time.